A little background for those joining us today. On October 9th and 10th, 2018, World Mental Health Day, the UK government hosted a global mental health ministerial summit with the intention of laying out a course of action to implement mental health policies globally. In the same week, the Lancet Commission on Global Mental Health and Sustainable Development published a report outlining a proposal for scaling up mental health care globally. In response, a coalition of mental health activists and service users have organized an open letter detailing their concerns with the summit and the report. The response has attracted the support of policymakers, psychologists, psychiatrists, and researchers. In our last episode, we are joined by Dr. Melissa Raven, a critical psychologist and epidemiologist, who discussed problems with the scientific evidence base used by the global mental health movement. She also emphasized the need to consider responses to the distress and suffering of people globally that address the social determinants of mental health, including things like poverty, education, and healthcare. Today, we turn our focus to the concerns raised by the mental health activists in response to the UK summit and the Lancet report. To discuss these issues, we are joined first by Jill Mill Breckenridge, a poet, writer, and mental health activist. Jill Mill is the founder of Bohr Foundation, an Indian charity which is active in mental health advocacy, the trauma-informed approach, and enabling other choices to heal apart from the biomedical model. Jill Mill also heads a team leading MAD in Asia Pacific. This is an online webzine working for better rights, justice, and inclusion for people with psychosocial disability in the Asia Pacific region. She is currently working on a PhD in creative writing in the UK, and for the last 3 years, she has also been leading an online poetry therapy group for women recovering from domestic violence. She is working on a few initiatives, both in the UK and India, taking this approach into prisons and asylums. Her debut poetry collection, titled Reclamation Song, was published in May 2018. Welcome to the Mad in America podcast, Jill Mill. Thanks for joining us.
It's a delight to be here.
Thank you. Tell us a little bit about how you became a mental health activist and why you felt the need to challenge the Western treatment approaches being implemented in India.
Sure. So, I started because I myself had issues with mental health distress. And I faced sexual trauma in my marriage, and because of which in India, it's very easy. You know, there isn't really a rights-based approach, or there wasn't 10, 11 years ago. And my ex-husband and family needed to have me incarcerated into a mental health hospital, which is very much still run like a colonial asylum. And so this was back in 2007. And, since that time, and a little bit before as well, you know, ever since my own issues with distress happened, I've always been very vocal, very outspoken. But particularly from that time of just everything being, you know, your rights just being taken and you're then labeled forever. From that time, I've been doing a lot of advocacy and a lot of work on the ground, as well as with policymakers, and trying to change the laws in India so that it's not as easy to just lock up people just because someone wants to lock them up. So this is really my journey as to why I'm a mental health activist and why I started Bohr Foundation, which works to do with the UN CRPD, the Convention for the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and just bring a different lens, you know, the trauma-informed approach, this kind of lens to look at mental health distress, that it's not just always a chemical imbalance in the brain, which is often the way it is sold or marketed in India. And that led me exactly into, why we need to challenge the Western treatment approaches, because currently in the urban setting in India, especially for the affluent or even the middle class, if someone goes to the doctor, the Western model is used. And the Western model, unfortunately, it's a huge country. The doctor doesn't have much time. So it's just high doses of medication without really too much investigation. And I believe there's a huge, huge problem with that, because medication, while good for a short term, should not be used for life. And this is what they say: oh, you have a chemical imbalance in the brain, now for the rest of your life you have to be on X or Y treatment or X or Y drug. And there are huge problems with this approach. I also believe in India and countries like India, we have our own ancient systems of healing, you know, communities, temples, dargahs, our own ancient ways of healing like Ayurveda, Yunani, where there are herbal and other remedies, including faith healing. And all of these do have a place in India. Even now, I do believe that with faith healing, there is also some community acceptance and community support. So again, just the Western treatment approach, blanket coming like that to India will create a lot of problems, because people will say, oh, you know, get away, do away with all the ancient methods. And I do think that there are problems with that. I think there has to be a more inclusive method to healing, and someone might heal better with an ancient method, the, you know, some dargah-based healing or some faith-based healing. Someone may have a short-term beneficial result with medication and then use other methods like therapy, etc. And again, there's this whole power imbalance, you know, because when there is the drugs and the psychiatrist and the white coat is at the top of the pyramid, and there are these huge power imbalances that they are like the god sitting there. And even though we have psychologists and counselors, they are not really very respected, not much is happening, and a lot needs to change. There's also, of course, in India, the problems with economics and social models. And I think we need to focus on things like, do people have enough food to eat? Are there enough jobs? Because, you know, maybe it's not a mental health issue that we are looking at. So the Western treatment itself is a very worrying term, because treatment means there's some aberration and something needs to be treated or fixed. Perhaps there's a reason why people are sad. Perhaps there's the human condition. So, you know, it goes on and on.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us and for talking about how there's some danger in applying the Western approaches in India. Can you tell us a little bit about the UK summit and the Lancet Commission and the lack of cooperation with disability rights groups like your foundation and other mental health activists?
Yes, you know, just last week, like as you mentioned, on the 9th and 10th of October, there was this UK ministerial summit. And, you know, I'm working in the UK right now. I'm living in the UK. My work is known about here as well as in Asia. And it was almost like there was a covert, almost sinister lack of involvement of service users, of people with lived experiences, of people, you know, mental health advocates like myself, or even academics, very few people. It was just a lot of people, you know, from the global mental health movement, which often pays lip service to the fact that, yes, we, you know, I was listening, in fact, this morning to a podcast on the Lancet report, which was introduced at this summit. And this Dr. Vikram Patel was saying, you know, we need to put the voices of people with lived experiences at the fore. But I believe this is just lip service, because if they had put the voices of people with lived experiences at the fore, there would have been a large group of mental health activists, disability rights activists, and other such groups at the summit. Unfortunately, the summit did not have these. And in fact, a colleague, Dr. China Mills, whose article is going to be coming out probably tomorrow or day after on Mad in Asia, she went there in disguise because she hadn't been invited. And, you know, she's written about the conference for us. And, you know, she said that in the UK, where we are talking about austerity, you know, the UK, the service users in the UK are really facing a lot of problems, because the UK government is cutting down on services, on hospitals, on hospital beds. And yet there was this really lavish summit, you know, with wine and champagne and a boat taking you for 2 minutes away, and you're being transported by boat to these fancy receptions. Is it not hypocritical that the UK government is positioning themselves as a global mental health champion, when in their own country, people are suffering? You know, I work with service users here in the UK. The caregivers are bothered. The service users are bad. The NHS, which is the National Health Service in the UK, they are offered, an average person after a long wait is offered 6 sessions of psychotherapy. Now, in 6 sessions, nothing really is going to happen. So I really think, you know, this whole ministerial summit and the UK positioning themselves, it all seems like a bit of hogwash. And I also want to know, you know, who paid for all these very lavish spreads? Who is paying for research? There are very troubling questions coming up in my mind. There's so many examples. You know, I know of so many of these big pharma companies who will fund so-called research and then position their drug, and especially in countries like India and Asia, where we don't have enough knowledge or not enough government think tanks and government bodies in place. It's too easy to just be doing that. So I'm again troubled by, you know, who paid for this lavish ministerial summit. And there is a lot of anger on the ground. And you mentioned that open letter, which came out on the National Survivor User Network. And I'm a signatory on that, both as a founder of Whole Foundation, as well as lead editor for Mad in Asia. And I really think it's very troubling. And there's a lot of anger.
And we hope to host Dr. China Mills on our podcast in the following weeks and to hear more from her about what took place at this summit. You mentioned that service users and people with psychosocial disabilities were excluded from the summit and the Lancet report, but you've also mentioned how the global mental health movement more generally takes an ableist lens to the way it portrays people in distress around the world. Can you tell us more about what you mean?
Yes, of course. In the Lancet report, for example, some of the phrases that is often mentioned, one of them is the burden of disease. Now, this word or this phrase as burden of disease is very troubling to me, because mental health, again, if you just look at it through the illness lens, it's looking at the person and it's not really looking at the societal lens. And so again, you know, this whole burden of disease, and is it a disease? Is it an illness? And then burden, you know, burden on whom? Is it then a burden on society? And there is just this whole fascination and obsession, you know, because it's the capitalist model. Everyone is obsessed with productivity. Everyone is obsessed with not being a burden. And I think that, you know, if someone is sad or upset or depressed, it is up to the community or the village to figure out what is the problem. And I don't think in ancient times this was looked upon as a burden. And this is a capitalist lens, as I say, and the global mental health, also the movement, takes this whole ableist lens that there are these normal people and then there are these abnormal people who are a burden and they shouldn't be a burden. And this whole ableist approach, you know, we discuss it so much in disability work, in cross-disability work, and how, you know, I mean, even language has to change. Like, we've gone from words like confined in a wheelchair to wheelchair user. And, you know, just simple things like that. We have to stop using words like burden, confined, restricted, because these are all societal constructs. And we need to look at people in distress with a more compassionate, more inclusive lens, that, you know, what has happened to the person? Perhaps they are a refugee. Perhaps they're living in war. Perhaps they have had marital rape or, you know, childhood sexual abuse. We need to look at this so-called burdens and figure out why they are the burdens, and then try and look at that. And, you know, just in my own, you know, I'm a poet. You had mentioned that I just had a book out and I use poetry as therapy. And I think that people need time to be free, to observe, to paint, to think. And if everyone is just producing, it's a very big problem. There will be no artists and poets and thinkers. And just lastly, I want to just mention that 2 days ago I was in London. And, you know, I currently live in a very small town called Preston. But when I go to London, and when I was there, in fact, 2 days ago, I am noticing, you know, I got off in the train station and there are all these people just staring at their screens on their smartphones. Everyone in a line is getting up on those escalators. The escalators are going up. So 20 years ago, we had science fiction films which showed that, you know, how people are going to be turned into automatons, just producing. I think we have reached that point that we are the people in those science fiction films.
That's a great point. And it speaks also to the point you made about exporting an idea about what mental health looks like and what mental health treatment looks like to other countries when we haven't necessarily reflexively looked at how those concepts are impacting the West. You mentioned that the global mental health plan that was laid out in the UK last week is meant to be implemented worldwide, including in India, where your foundation does its work. Can you talk a little bit about your concerns about this strategy in India and how your group takes a different approach there?
So, you know, when the words global mental health are used, they are also used in the same vein with words like, intervention and treatment. There are all of these kind of words being used with global mental health. I think that just taking it to India, where we have much bigger problems, poverty, people living under the poverty line. There are so many other ways in which we have to look at why people are living in distress. I mean, for example, we have farmer suicides in our country because the crop is not yielding what it should yield, and so they are not able to feed their families because they can't sell the crop. And there are many farmers committing suicide. Now, if a Western model is to look at this, they will think, oh, the farmers are depressed, they are committing suicide, let's give them drugs. I don't think giving them drugs or a Western treatment model is going to fix the problem. You need to say, okay, this land is arid, it's not giving us crop. Perhaps we can help these people to get trained in cattle farming. Perhaps we can have them be trained in something else. The government needs to get involved. I think it's a lot of just passing the buck. People are not really looking at what is causing the farmer suicides, and they will try and then just put like a band-aid on top of a fracture. And this will not work because obviously if the land is not going to produce, giving them drugs is not going to make the land produce. And they will still have the same problem. And now they will be dopey and have all the other side effects which come with treatment. So my group, we take a much, much different approach, of course, always looking at trauma at the core. We look at adverse childhood effects, and we look at, what has happened. And then we try and work with the community. We work a lot with peer support, with non-hierarchical peer support kind of models. I think we need to think about all of this. And also, global mental health, one of the other troubling points is they mention treatment gap over and over. But I keep saying, why don't we work on prevention and work on lifestyle and nutrition and societal, strengthen the societal and social and environmental factors so that there is less distress and less mental health issues.
One of the other terms that's used frequently in the new Lancet report and in the global mental health movement more generally is this idea that you can reduce mental health stigma through education and the use of technology in order to get more people into treatment. You have pointed out issues with the application of this framing of anti-stigma campaigns in India in the past. Can you talk about your concerns with this?
Yes, of course. Stigma is very real. Stigma is very real, especially in a country like India, where people with mental health labels and conditions, people, families will not talk about it if someone is suffering. And in India, a lot of people do have depression, schizophrenia, some of the more difficult mental health labels that, and people can just lock their family member up into a colonial style asylum because they can, and then they can pretend the person doesn't exist. So there is a lot of stigma. But the point is, I feel that, we need to start looking at other ways, because if it's just stigma, then we're looking again at the person being the problem. I think we need to start saying, for example, in India, talk about things like childhood sexual abuse or pedophilia or, caregivers. If a person has got, bipolar disorder, perhaps they had an unhappy childhood, and we need to start addressing that. But anti-stigma campaign is not going to help that, because an anti-stigma campaign will just, again, be labeling the person that, oh, this person is depressed or this person is unproductive, using the same productivity lens. They are not going to talk about the family issues. And they'll just say, oh, once he starts going to the doctor, or once he just starts talking about it or getting some treatment, they will get better. So I think, for example, because the one they are going to try and replicate is the one called the Time to Change campaign, which is the campaign in the UK, and it's already spent millions and millions of pounds on it. And they want to take that kind of a campaign to India. I think we have to be very careful, because it again perpetuates the illness model, the problem that one person has the problem and that person will get better with treatment. And technology really bothers me, and using technology, because again, technology, most technology will still take people down decision trees, and in order to slot them into boxes, again, trying to make a case for treatment, or again replicating the troubling DSM ways of labeling people by disorder. So technology, I think in a country which is human resource rich, we have a lot of people, there is no, and you know, manpower is cheap in India. I think it's better to train more people on the ground, create more community workers. Technology will again just be perpetuating the biomedical approach and slotting people into boxes. And everyone is anyway on smartphones. There will be an over-medicalizing of the human condition. There will be an over-diagnosis, like in America, where children of, 8, 9-year-old children are on Ritalin and all kinds of psychotropic medication. And I think this will be a huge problem, because we don't want it to become just a normal everyday thing, like you're popping vitamins and you're popping psychotropic drugs. We don't want our children to be medicalized, put into those boxes, which is already happening in some of the more progressive schools and progressive cities in Delhi, in Mumbai. You know, there are now these school counselors, and I'm a mother of 4 boys. And boys have a greater likelihood of being called ADHD, and then going down that whole treatment route. And we need to accept everyone is different, and some children will play more and be more hyperactive. So this whole stigma thing bothers me, and technology is very worrying.
Indeed, we've covered some research on Madden America, looking at the effect of anti-stigma campaigns that have been rolled out in different countries. And the results suggest that when these stigma campaigns use messages that construe mental distress as biological illness, it actually increases the likelihood that people will stay away, or increases the likelihood of social distancing in their communities. And research by John Reed and Eleanor Longden suggests that psychosocial explanations, like the ones you're talking about, increase empathy and responsiveness within those same communities. It seems to tie in well with your work advocating for a trauma-informed approach. Can you talk a little bit about how using this framework to address distress and emotional difficulties around the world looks very different from what the Lancet report is advocating?
You know, we use the trauma-informed approach a lot. And as you mentioned, John Reed and others like that, and many other people, activists, advocating for psychosocial disability and ways to deal with it. We have been saying this whole thing about the societal lens and childhood abuse and adverse effects. And in the Lancet report, for the first time, I think they have mentioned this. They call it the convergent theory, where they are saying, okay, we're looking at the societal lens and the genetic markers. But they are almost as if they have come up with this whole thing. They don't give credit to any of these other people who have been talking about it for the last 10, 20 years, as if they have come up with it themselves. So I think the Lancet report is just stealing many people's ideas and presenting it almost like, taking an old concept and presenting it as their own. And it's very, very bad to do that. I think, as you mentioned earlier, that this whole concept of empathy. So when we look at the societal lens, and when we look at it as a psychosocial disability rather than as mental illness, we may see an abusive husband causing sexual trauma. We may see an older cousin abusing a younger cousin. And there's a lot of incest in India. There is a lot of, we still have joint families, and we still have you know, children and many people sleeping in the same room, and things would just get sort of swept under the carpet. So we have a lot of problems with this whole being okay with marital rape. And I think when we look at distress and what is happening to cause the mental health issues, there is then, of course, empathy and compassion. But also, I think it's important to see that, you know, when we start calling out the marital rapist or the abuser, we are then labeling the perpetuator and not just the victim, which is right now what is happening. Because right now, if the person showing the symptoms of mental health distress is you know, acting erratically, they will be the one with getting the label of bipolar disorder or anxiety. And the person who has been raping them or abusing them or whatever is the reason, it could be poverty, it's not always a sexual thing, it could be economic thing. Those people, the perpetuator, they are not labeled, or they are, you know, they get away scot-free. So I think when we look at these models, we do come up with a more just world and a world where we will have better rights, better treatment, better, I don't want to say the word treatment, but you know what I'm trying to say. I also want to just add that in India, you know, we do have this panchayat model, and the panchayat model is the elders of the village. The panchayat is normally, a panch comes from five. Panch is the Hindi word for five. And it normally means that there will be a group of village elders, and every Sunday or once a month, people who have a problem in the village, they are able to go to them, and the village elders will listen to them asking for justice. So in this model, for example, a woman who's being abused in her marriage or by her in-laws or in any case like that, she can go and ask the village elders and ask for justice. The village elders can take a view, and often the abuser is also recognized, and there can be a temporary separation, and there is shame for the abuser and not the victim. But if we take the global mental health model, you know, that will not at all look at the abuser. It will just keep doing more of the treatment and medicalizing the affected person while the abuse might still continue. And therefore, I'm really very anxious of these terms like treatment gap, care, illness.
Thank you for highlighting the differences and the way in which there might be some danger in implementing a model without considering existing social practices in a country like India. Another alternative framework you've discussed is your poetry as therapy model. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, so I have been using poetry as therapy here in the UK. I go into a National Health Service. It is called a secure unit. A secure unit is like a cross between a prison and a mental health facility where there are people who are offenders, but they also have a mental health label. And so it's like a prison, and you go in and these people are not allowed to go out. And I've been using poetry as therapy here with them. And it's very, very powerful because, you know, these are people who have lost their voice in a way. They are just, you know, they are just put away. They don't know how long. There are people there who've been there for 10 years, and there's this very young, brilliant man, Ellis, and he's like a rap star, you know. He's so good. His words are so good. And I'm like, wow, Ellis, that's such a gift. But the thing is that he keeps saying, you know, I keep coming up for parole and then I'm never let out. So their weekly sessions of poetry, he really was looking forward to them. And, you know, it was much better than so many of the other things that they were doing, you know, like there was yoga and there was pottery and this, that, because they felt very empowered that finally someone is listening to their voice, their words, and then even just sitting and writing, you know, what is going on with them. I would leave them with prompts. It is very, very therapeutic, very cathartic. And I've been, of course, doing this with victims of domestic violence. And I think we need to create more models like this. A friend of mine in India does dance and movement as therapy. And trauma, when we look at trauma, you know, Dr. Bessel van der Ork has written this book called Body Keeps the Score. And the Body Keeps the Score talks about how trauma resides in other parts of the body. So we need to be looking at these alternative models of therapy, poetry as therapy, movement as therapy, and even remove the word therapy, because therapy itself is troubling in itself. But right now, for want of a better word, I'm using it to say that, you know, these kind of approaches, dance, poetry, art, movement, massage, and then nutrition, you know, all of these things put the body at the fore and not the mind. And the global mental health movement keeps putting the mind at the fore. And I do think that mental health distress is just health, and we need to look at the whole body. And poetry as therapy has really, you know, it's one of my passions. I write about it, I speak about it, I conduct these classes. So I think that we need to be thinking more about these alternatives, and not just, you know, pills, and not just the Western models, which will unfortunately just be taken and dumped in countries like India.
Given the healing power of poetry that you've discussed, I know that you're willing to read us one of your newer poems today, Button, from a Me Too anthology, which was also published on the BBC. We'll end with your reading of the poem. And before we go, I just want to thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your story and for sharing your worries about the global mental health movement. Thank you.
So this is Button. And this was written from through my own life. And luckily, I'm no longer with the husband I talk about in this poem. So here's Button. Persuaded to try medication, very few side effects, no problem. Dr. Atul smiles at your husband. You are just a possession, a car to service, a house to maintain. He proudly leads you home, 10 mg of this and that, and a brand new wife. Your voice does not matter. The thickening tongue, the diminishing libido, your body not your own. Your limbs swim in treacle, your mind anesthetized. Your smile pasted. The new improved wife, model 101, will last without complaint. Just press the button.
Thank you so much. That was beautiful.
Good to talk with you, Justin.
For our second interview on the response of mental health activists to the UK summit and the Lancet report, we are joined by Dr. Bhargavi Devar. She identifies as a childhood survivor of psychiatric institutions in India. She went on to train as a philosopher and social science researcher at the Indian Institute of Technology in Bombay, and has published and co-edited several books, including Psychoanalysis as a Human Science, Mental Health of Indian Women, and Gendering Mental Health, while also producing collections of poems and short stories. Dr. Devar is an international trainer in the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the CRPD, and the founder of the Bapu Trust for Research on Mind and Discourse in India. This organization aims to give visibility to user survivor-centered mental health advocacy and studies traditional healing systems in India. Welcome to the Madden America podcast, Dr. Devar.
Thank you so much, Justin. I'm really happy to join you in this podcast. I'm a long time admirer of Madden America and Bob's work. I think it's one of the best evidence-based platforms online for people like us in the Global South who have no access to library resources from the West. So thanks to Madden America for inviting me into this platform, and thanks to you for giving this time.
Thank you. And thank you for your contributions to Madden America as well. In your recent blog post for Madden America, you discussed the Transforming Communities for Inclusion, TCI group, and the Asia Pacific section in particular, and the work that this group is doing to counter the globalization of Western psychiatric practice. To get us started, would you mind setting the stage a little bit? What is the TCI group? How did it form, and what are the goals of the group?
You mentioned the Bapu Trust for Research on Mind and Discourse. We started in 1999, and it was really a big struggle trying to establish mental health advocacy in India. We were excluded, laughed at, silenced, made invisible. And I think though the situation continues until very recently, where just to talk about human rights of persons with psychosocial disabilities is not accepted at all. And then came the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities. We were quite active in that. At this time, we also joined the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry, which came with a very Western Global North views about advocacy. We couldn't relate to it very much because in the Asia-Pacific region, as I traveled more and more, I found that there weren't many institutions, many countries did not have mental health legislations. There was barely any psychiatry, and certainly there were not many angry users and survivors. So our exposure to the advocacy movement in the Global North was a bit mixed. Met amazing people like Chris Hansen, Mary O'Hagan, Judy Chamberlain, some of the leaders, pioneering leaders of the transformatory movement in the West. But it was a bit isolated for us in the Bapu Trust. And so slowly we started looking for peers in our own region and Nepal, Philippines, Indonesia, Fiji, China, Hong Kong. Traveled a lot, made connect with emerging leaders in these countries. And we started to define our own expression of mental health advocacy for Asia. Then I think one of the key learnings for me was that that's where colonialism came up in a big way for us. Nepal was never colonized. They don't have a mental health law. They don't have institutions in the way that that we have them in a post-colonial country like India. They don't have the old baggage of medico-legal frameworks. For example, Nepal doesn't have a guardianship law, which most all Commonwealth countries have. But it was good to, it was like a breath of fresh air to travel to countries which were never colonized or were not colonized by the British, and to see what those systems are like. It was also a bit of a relief to know that not every country has these oppressive medico-legal traditions which the British left behind for us here in India and in all the Commonwealth countries of Asia. Yeah, and so, and that's when we started to get together and share experiences and to see, okay, what can we do in the Asian region? And because there were not many institutions and not many psychiatrists, our movement started to define itself in a different way. The violations, of course, happened, but they happened more in communities, so much within institutions, or they happened within shelters, things that family members put together, like bamboo cages, prayer halls, things like that. So it happened more in communities without legal sanction. There was no mental health law to allow violence. And so we started to discuss whether we should call ourselves user survivors of psychiatry, and felt that that was too disempowering and it pitched us against the medical system. Whereas what we really want is life in communities. And so we called ourselves Transforming Communities for Inclusion of Persons with Psychosocial Disabilities Asia. What is our goal? We would like to meet and mobilize all Asian countries and all Pacific countries. Right now, we're focusing on South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia, and Pacific. But we hope that sooner or later, we will also have friends in West Asia. We meet a lot in order to share and learn, particularly about what inclusion means. We've done several studies on inclusion. There is pedagogy around legal capacity. There's pedagogy around liberty, right to liberty and right to life. But there's not much pedagogy around what inclusion means. Modern law takes family and community for granted. So there's really no explication within the scope of law for what inclusion means and how to promote it through human rights legislation. And so we are keen to see more, more ideation, more concepts, more theories, more academics and more practice on the subject of inclusion. Interestingly, in India, we have two legislations. One is the old Colonial Mental Lunacy Act. Now we have a new version of it, which is called the Mental Health Care Act. But even that act, which has coercion at its core, even that act has the provision for right to live independently and be included in communities. So slowly legislations are coming in with new formulations on inclusion, which is a good thing. Another aspect of our work is to strengthen national advocacy. We support emerging leaders in Asian countries and Pacific countries. And we take out what we call country missions, where some of us go and exchange with the local partners, the cross-disability movement, and the other stakeholders, for example, family caregiver groups, service providers, of which there are so few in Asian countries. So we exchange with them and we bring news about the CRPD, sometimes perhaps a 2 to 3 day full-blown training on the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And we try to kind of encourage the National Cross-Disability Alliance to include persons with psychosocial disabilities within their membership. And in this way, sometimes we've even seen a disabled people's organization develop out of this, our facilitation in countries. We participate in global processes. We write to the UN when they ask for draft comments on any of their drafts. And we participate in UN regional meetings. And Bali Declaration was one of the advocacy documents. It's the first one which is so comprehensive. We are very happy with this. And we feel that it's useful, not just for our region, but also for the rest of the world.
Thank you. I wanted to ask another question about the Bali Declaration, which you mentioned. The TCI Asia Pacific group issued the statement in August, and it criticized mental health providers in these regions for infringing upon the human rights of persons with psychosocial disabilities. The declaration calls for, quote, a paradigm shift towards inclusion and away from a medical model or a sole focus on mental health. Can you tell us what led to the development of the Bali Declaration and the importance of the UN CRPD that you mentioned?
Well, in present times, I think that the Asian region, particularly due to the active capacity building done by organizations like the International Disability Alliance, that's IDA, most of us in the disability movement are well-informed or trained directly on the CRPD. We've had opportunities to participate in the national reporting process, the parallel report writing process with cross-disability alliances. We've had opportunities to travel to New York to participate in the conference of state parties with respect to the CRPD. We've had opportunities to travel to Geneva to contribute to several general comments, for example, on participation, on legal capacity, on Article 19, which is on inclusion. We've had the opportunity to engage with the special rapporteurs like Dr. Danius Puras and his recent report on right to higher standard of health. We've had opportunity to engage with Ms. Catalina Devandas from the Special Rapporteur's Office of Disabilities, contribute to some of her reports. So we've had huge exposure compared to the mental health advocacy movement, the user survivor movement in Global North. I think a lot of us in low-income, middle-income countries are by now very much familiar with what is expected after the ratification of the Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Another important development, strategic development for our region is that there is close collaboration, if not partnership, if not membership, within the cross-disability movement. So I think it's been so important for us to just say that, look, we're not part of the mental health movement, but we're really part of the cross-disability movement. We are post-CRPD as TCI Asia Pacific. TCI Asia Pacific is what it is because we were born after the CRPD and because of the CRPD. So the way we pitch our advocacy is very different from, say, the WNUSP, the European Network of User Survivors in Psychiatry, and so on. So we just came much later, and so we came with the wisdom of the CRPD. And that's why we say that there could be two gates for entering advocacy and ensuring our rights. One gate is through the mental health gate. You know, you continue to battle the mental health systems, mental health laws, mental health professionals. That's one way. As you know, most of us get exhausted in this battle because we are alone, and people, they don't listen to us anymore now than they did, say, 60 years ago. And also in our region, there aren't many psychiatrists, like I said, and there's not much of a battle going on. And whereas the cross-disability movement post-CRPD in the last 10 years is, it has strength of numbers. It does continue to have a spirit of collaboration and partnership. It does welcome us. We are not invisible within the cross-disability movement. Usually they tend to ask us and include us in, you know, the important political processes that they're engaged in. And so it's been empowering for us to work with the cross-disability movement and post our demands, our requests within the larger development framework. So we can say we want jobs, we want education, allow us to complete our education, provide us reasonable accommodation within workspaces. We will do sports. We will participate in marriage festivals and other cultural activities. So we, if we go through this gate, then there are a number of opportunities which open up for us. When you reduce our rights to just a right to mental health care, that's a dead end, you know, and that's a dead end. You either say, okay, mental health, what do you have to offer? You know, you offer many kinds of violations of human rights. And that's not a choice for us. It's oppression. Excuse me. You have got the words wrong. You're not offering us choice. But as we go through the development gate, then, you know, there's really a lot out there. And when you enter through the development gate, healthcare is only one of the many rights which are available. So a lot of us in Asia Pacific decided that we will look for inclusion as a clarion call for our movement in the Asia Pacific and not really just pitch ourselves against the medical system. And when we talk inclusion, then we carry the cooperations of the cross-disability movement. It works for us.
Thank you. Given the advances that you mentioned in the cross-disability movement growing out of the CRPD and the rights outlined in the Bali Declaration, can you talk a little bit about how the recent Lancet Commission report and the global mental health movement more generally measure up in comparison to these, to this other framework? And how is the global mental health movement incorporating this cross-disability paradigm? And in what ways are they really missing the mark?
Well, I don't know, you know, because you can see that there is a hybrid language developing within mental health today. It's when we started advocating for the CRPD, ensuring our rights within the scope of the CRPD, there was a very different response from the medical professionals 10 years ago. For a long time, they just ignored the CRPD or really wrote against the CRPD, very much with the interest to maintain the status quo with respect to mental health. So earlier when there were conferences, you would hear things like, you know, should institutions go or should they remain? What is the importance of having mental institutions? And trust me, in our region, we don't have mental hospitals. We have mental asylums. And I think that's true worldwide. You know, as long as you have penal provisions, that's still a colonial practice wherever it may occur. But slowly, you know, though times changed and people are actually recognizing that you cannot ignore the CRPD anymore. And so more and more hybrid languages are coming up. For example, in India, we have a law which is sugar-coated with CRPD, but has coercion at the core. But surprisingly, this law has given rise to a few important and positive jurisprudence on involuntary commitment. And so I think things are changing. Global mental health, again, it has moved from filling the treatment gap to actually recognizing the role of development in impacting mental health, both positively and negatively. I have to confess that the Lancet paper, which is just out, is really a very long paper. I haven't read all of it. But there's a big topic on participation when it comes to the Global Mental Health Summit, the Global Disability Summit. We've been to a lot of these global conferences, including the Conference of State Parties, the Global Disability Summit, and several such events. And it's considered a moral wrong these days not to include us in those meetings where policies are discussed which will impact us. So Nothing About Us Without Us has gone really deep into the policymaking circles worldwide. So it was quite a surprise for us that this meeting was by the doctors, for the doctors. And we were not invited, or we were given a very kind of, okay, you can be a backbencher and listen to what's going on kind of role with respect to the Global Mental Health Summit. Yeah, so that's one big concern that we all had. And why is it that if you say that you're following the CRPD, then right on top of that document is the right to participation, which will ensure dignity. And so why would you not do that? And the other is, of course, you read the Lancet paper and look at the schedule. We issued our own letter. A big concern is that while the Lancet paper talks about mental health with a broader framework, it's brought in lots of stuff on development, brought in lots of stuff on psychosocial interventions, non-formal caregivers, non-formal service providers, and all of that. It doesn't touch the elephant in the room. What are we going to do with all the drugs which are flooding North countries and which will now be loaded onto big ships to cross over different oceans to reach us in the Asia-Pacific region? So that's a big concern, If it was like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when drugs were experimental and you were flooding populations with those experimental drugs and you didn't know what harm it caused, this is one kind of moral question. Today, you know the harm it causes, and still, you export them to our lands. I think it's gone beyond morality. It's not a moral question anymore. You don't have a choice. You don't do this. That's it. So that's one of the big concerns that we have, that your institutions have failed. You know that your mental health laws have failed. You know that you have caused harm worldwide. And why would you want to do this to the so-called global south, which is low-income, middle-income countries? Why would a community of farmers who are in debt, poverty, environmental degradation due to various, political actions taken in agriculture in India today, why would you want to go to a community like this and tell them that you want to fill the treatment gap? So this is, for me, for us in Asia Pacific region, is astonishing that a country can do this. This is a big topic for us.
Thank you. In your blog, in response to the recent UK summit on World Mental Health Day that appeared on Mad in America, you refer to the phenomenon of the North driving the South. Can you say more about the colonial legacy of psychiatry in India and the, quote, global South, and how the rush to fill the treatment gap, as it's put in the movement, can be seen as a continuation of these practices?
India, there are other Commonwealth nations, Singapore, Malaysia. There are also the British protectorates. So you have the Fiji Islands. Some of them were Tonga. Tonga is a recent example of a country having got independence, though it was never part of the British colony, but it was a protectorate. So we have a whole bunch of countries like this in the Asia Pacific region, and I dare say in other, in Africa for sure. And so we have a template. The blueprint of mental health system is derived from the British framework. So we have all these countries have, some of them continue to have the old lunacy law. Example, Maldives, I think so. It has the old lunacy law of 1912. So from 1858, we had the Lunatic Asylums Act, and we had the Lunacy Act. And it became the Mental Health Act in the 1990s. And then now we have the Mental Health Care Act. And over the years, the naming of people who will receive this law has changed from a lunatic, idiot, person of unsound mind to presently person with high support need, you know, in the Mental Health Care Act. But the penal format of the legislation has not changed. So in the heart of the legislation is involuntary admission, use of coercion. There is, of course, a lot of CRPD language used in the mental health care law, but at the core, there is involuntary commitment. And as you will know, worldwide, and also here, you know, in the countries where the coercive law exists, there is no way that you can apprehend a person without violating their dignity, without violating their physical and mental integrity. So you really have to do something to the physical body of a person in order to apprehend them and put them away. And so this is something for which the global mental health movement talks about evidence base all the time. But how doing this to someone will actually result in filling the treatment gap? Why is this violation of apprehending someone physically, either through restraints or through chemical restraints, whatever it may be, why this is a part of medical treatment? Why is this a medical action rather than a penal action? So there are these peculiarities which are found in colonial legal frameworks, which people have tried to convert a penal framework into a medical framework. But we have to really recognize the fact that mental health law, wherever it exists, is pre-human rights. It was born of colonialism. It was born through the war period. It was born through, you know, periods when people were putting people away for reasons of social control, reasons of saving the face of the colonizer, for reasons which are quite different from medical reasons. And so such a law, you know, you suddenly cannot transform it by, you know, by magic into a medical law. It never was and it never will be. And so that's what we are looking at when the North comes to us and say, okay, let's fill the treatment gap. This is what they bring. I haven't seen an article by the Global Mental Health Movement really questioning and challenging the colonial framework of the institutions, of the laws. In fact, you know, the leaders of the global mental health movement have written recently in Indian newspapers how wonderful our Mental Health Care Act is, that it's one of the most progressive acts in the world. This is not really CRPD compliant, that's for sure. Recently, there's this debate going on in Twitter that after the law was changed in the UK in 2008, actually, the number of detentions went up several notches, like several, like went up like many times over. And I take the case of Korea as well, where they brought in a new Mental Health Act because, well, the WHO has been saying very loudly for a long time that a country without a mental health law is not very modern. They brought in a Mental Health Act in 2008, and the number of institutions in that country went up like by 200 times. So now they have the highest number of institutions in our part of the world. So also now with Thailand, they're struggling with how to deinstitutionalize. They brought in a law in late in 2008, 2009, something like that. And so these are facts that bring to me again and again that dealing with an old system here, which is trying to wear new clothes, but that's not going to happen.
You mentioned that the colonial mental health policies and laws that were put on the books sometimes acted to save the face of the colonizers. And certainly there's some parallel here to what you termed the North driving the South phenomenon, with a summit in the UK not including the voices of people with psychosocial disabilities in the countries in which they intend to implement this policy. Can you say something about how this current framework might also serve to save the face of the global North?
That's a tough one. I don't think I have the answers to that. But I do think, you know, that as one would expect, if moral grounds are still a foundation on which governments and societies function, that a country which has colonized several other countries over centuries would self-reflect and come back with, okay, you know, yeah, that happened and that was wrong. But we don't see that kind of remorse. And in fact, it's sad that countries come back with intent to do more harm, knowing fully well that the kind of mental health systems that they created for themselves have destroyed large populations within their own countries. But it appears that within policy, there is no morality. These kinds of moral questions are not asked. And I don't think it's a one-way thing, by the way. I think that there were a lot of people who were colonized who were very complicit with this receiving this kind of framework from the British. So it's not that we are the victims of an external process. We imbibed it. We welcomed it. In fact, some of the global mental health professionals, many of them are from the global South, particularly India. So I do think it's a moral question, though as an individual, I can only think in terms of morality. I don't know how governments process morality, but I think they should.
Thank you. And how would adopting a rights-based framework, a framework with moral values, as presented by the UN Special Rapporteur, Danius Puris, and the CRPD, wondering how that framework might look different on the ground compared to the proposals being outlined in the UK summit and by the global mental health movement?
Well, for sure, you know, we constantly do this in our CRPD trainings. Imagine a world where the CRPD is realized. Draw a rich picture of what that would look like. And session after session, training program after training program, People can imagine. And today, unlike, say, 7-8 years ago, there are many good practice examples of supported decision-making on the ground, of deinstitutionalization, of you know, changes in law reform. We had this amazing law recently from Peru, which did away with guardianship. We have good practice examples. We have one, Bapu Trust. We've worked with peer support systems, setting up community support systems, neighborhood care systems, all of that in low-income communities in Pune City. And it's a 15-year-old project, but it became sharpened and more satisfactory for us from the CRPD perspective in the last 7 to 8 years. And here we bring people together on, you know, on support and care, especially for people with high support needs. I believe that because of our program, institutionalization is greatly reduced. We have been able to empower families and make. I think the key is to link with development services, not after people have taken their medicines, not after they have recovered from their mental illness. And not after all the stuff has happened, you know, when you take those drugs, but right from the start of knowing that somebody is going through distress or disturbance, then to link them up with different kinds of development services, and particularly work and employment, food and nutrition, social support systems, building social capital, enhancing their human support systems, whether it's families or neighbors or friends or peers in their workplace or peers in their schools or colleges, having groups of volunteers or paid staff who can just be there to listen, befriending services, home visitors. So we have a whole bunch of stuff going on in people, in communities where people want to really see the CRPD flourish. I think that's one of the big things about the Bali Declaration. Again and again, we are saying that professionals, mental health professionals, psychiatrists, do not gatekeep. Do not make trade-offs. You know, you take your pills, you recover, and then you go to job. You take your pills, you recover, and then you go to your yoga class. You recover, take your pills, and then you go play football. No way. Stop the gatekeeping. People have all the rights as they are.
I think that's a wonderful conclusion to this podcast. So thank you so much for being available for this interview and for making time to speak about this issue.
Thanks a lot, Justin, for the opportunity.